Hello and welcome to the FV English podcast, your one-stop shop for Venezuelan football in English, bringing you fortnightly episodes dedicated to the Venezuelan league, the national teams and the myriad of Venezuelan players around the world. Today we are joined by Ryan Boldy, author of The Next Big Thing and brand new book coming when this podcast drops within a month or so, The Dream Factory, inside the make or break world of football's academies. Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I think let's start with The Dream Factory purely for the cover. There's a very topical person on the front, of course, Marcus Rashford, also Trent Alexander-Arnold, but Marcus Rashford. Of course, you would have watched the England final Sunday. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it was, I really enjoyed the tournament as a whole. I think England did really well, of course, getting further than they ever have before in European Championships. And I think it was a great achievement by this young team. I think my personal experience with this team has been that I haven't been too engaged with the England team for a few years, but the fact that this team just seems like a good set of people has drawn me back and drawn my support back. And I think that from the people I've been speaking to throughout this tournament, I think that's been an experience many people would also reflect. So it was great to see this group of young men who were all so impressive individuals, and the manager, of course, as well, achieve what they did. It was a shame in the end they couldn't quite get over the line with the shootout, and obviously all the awful fallout was terrible and something that we don't want to see repeated. But I think there are a lot of positive signs for English football, and of course it plays into everything that has gone into the book that you mentioned that is due to drop soon.
And what particularly drew me to inviting you onto the podcast, the topics that you write about? So, like I said, with The Dream Factory, the subtitle being Inside the Make or Break World of Football's Academies, and the one of The Next Big Thing is about how football's wonder kids lose their way. Two topics that I think probably have an undercurrent in most footballing countries around the world, but particularly prevalent to me in Venezuela. There's plenty of young talent that seems to just never come to the fore in world football. Some people say it's because the impression that we get of young Venezuelan football players in Venezuela is perhaps inflated due to rules that they've got. For example, every team must field at least one under 20. So we're used to seeing a lot of young players play in the league that stand out from a young age, but perhaps we get a false impression of their quality. But also other factors much discussed over the years, like the idea of a passport tax on Venezuelans, that they're not given the same chances as perhaps Brazilians and Argentinians are from the South American continent, and also how youth development is structured in Venezuela. The idea of academies as we know them in Europe, and probably you're going to educate us even more so on, aren't quite the same in Venezuela. It's more left to private academies up until even the ages of 17, 18, at which point professional football clubs tend to take the players with very little need to compensate the academies. What were your main findings in, we'll start with The Dream Factory, that interested you about the coming of age of young players and that, I guess, that step from academy into professional?
Yeah, so I was interested in the whole journey, really, and the whole system. So it's a deep dive into the system as we know it, looking at basically how this new generation of young English players has come to be. So the likes of Marcus Rashford, Alexander Arnold, Phil Foden, Mason Mount, Jadon Sancho, looking at how they were all developed and created, but also looking at what the cost of that was, in terms of, you know, financially, but also in terms of the human cost of that, that we see from the football system in England, where so many players are swept into the system and the vast majority of them are discarded at some point. So I was very interested in the welfare aspect of the aftercare aspect, and then also the kind of day-to-day work of developing young footballers, which is something I managed to kind of do a deep dive into with a few key case studies. So the reason Rashford and Alexander Arnold are on the cover, because I spoke in great depth with people who've worked very closely with them throughout their time in youth football and throughout up until their rise into the first team, and was able to paint a pretty detailed picture of how they were developed both on and off the field, which was something I was really, really privileged to be able to kind of get access to do that and to visit the academies I was able to visit up and down England, and just learn as much about the whole system as I could, And yeah, I came away with it with a lot of questions going in, probably even more coming out, to be honest, because it's such a vast world. It's a world that's quite closed off to the outside, to the average fan. I managed to kind of infiltrate it, which to a degree to which I probably wasn't quite expecting. The level of access I got, I think, is pretty much unparalleled. And I felt very privileged to be able to get that kind of inside look that I had. You come away realizing that rather than it being a black or white kind of situation, there's lots of areas of grey. So youth football in England, especially at the elite levels, comes in for a lot of criticism, and rightly so, for the welfare aspect and for the sheer numbers that it drags in of young people and the attrition rates. But there's also a lot of good work being done as well, which we're seeing reflected now, both in the players being produced, but in the young people being developed and being encouraged, and everything that we've seen from the likes of Rashford and so many of the other English players. So yeah, I came away with a real deep understanding of the system and of the people within it, of all the different people who operate within it and the work they do, which I was able to put down on the page, and that's all in the book. But the overall impression, I came away realizing that there's probably just more nuance than many people would expect.
Were there any preconceptions you had about the English academy system that you perhaps were challenged on, or came out with a different viewpoint, particularly maybe a negative opinion? Because I know it's sort of the proxy attitude for a lot of young football fans to sort of have bad words to say about the academy system, because we know that there's so many players that just get churned out every year, and you know, only one in a million make it, that kind of thing.
Yes, I guess the main preconception I had was that it was very closed off, that it would be difficult to penetrate. Because I think, by and large, clubs don't reveal too much about what goes on behind the doors of their academies. And I wasn't sure how viable this project was going to be initially, or whether I was going to be able to get the access I would need to do this book. But I found that the people who do the day-to-day work, the people whose feet touch the grass, the coaches, the academy managers, are really proud of the work they do and are quite keen to discuss it. So I was able to have some really great in-depth discussions and go and visit these places and have a look into this world that I thought would probably be a bit more difficult to access. So that was one thing that I came away kind of surprised by, just the openness from the people, as I said, doing the day-to-day work. And then secondly, yeah, the aspect of the attrition rates and the welfare issues. I came away learning some kind of stark and difficult stories about players who've been through the system. I spoke to players and parents of players who have been released and who've felt the game has let them down, that the safety net that's supposed to be there to catch them wasn't quite in place. And people have been through some really difficult times, and also people who feel like they have a solution or feel like they have something to offer, who've gained no support from within the game, because from what I gather, the governing bodies and the clubs themselves feel as though they're closer to cracking the welfare issue than the lived experience of the people I spoke to would suggest. But at the same time, I was quite surprised and encouraged to learn just how keenly aware of their responsibility to these young people so many of the coaches and the academy managers are. So much aside from the policy shapers and the money men, who have the real power within youth football, within the world. The people who are there having the contact with these young people, for the vast majority of them are very aware of their responsibility and very cognizant of the attrition rates, and see their role as being one of developing young people, not just young footballers. And that was something I was really encouraged by.
I think with England getting to the final of the Euros, perhaps the only better publicity for your book that there could have been was England winning it. But what I found very interesting and relevant to your exact topic, posted by the England Twitter account itself in the days running up to the final, was basically a graphic thanking grassroots football for the players that they developed. And it really caught my eye, because a lot of parallels to how sort of football has happened or been appreciated in terms of youth development in Venezuela. To illustrate, as a Southampton fan, I'd like to have thought Luke Shaw is one of our own, kind of thing, and he got the goal, and I celebrated that like I grew up with the kid, and in reality I've never met him outside of a football stadium. But, you know, it didn't have Luke Shaw down as Southampton Academy. It had Luke Shaw down as Moseley Juniors. It didn't have Marcus Rashford down as Manchester United. It had him down as Fletcher Moss Rangers. And similarly, for other players that perhaps you'd have down as from a particular football academy, it had them down from, in reality, teams that the average football fan has never heard of. Do you think credit is given to the right people at the right levels? Or is it the case that it's the first professional academy to pick the player up that is getting the limelight?
Yeah, it's probably a bit of both in a way, because a lot of these players will have joined an academy at kind of 6 years of age. The rules that govern English youth football, the Elite Player Performance Plan that governs the top four divisions in England and their youth systems, dictates that clubs can't sign a player to a formal exclusive contract until they reach an under-9s level. But they can bring them in to train with them on an informal basis at any age, basically. So players are playing for these big clubs, or at least training with them and being exposed to at least sort of once weekly training sessions at elite academies from the ages of 5 and 6. So Mason Mount has been at Chelsea since he was 6, for example. He was scouted because I spoke to his dad, Tony Mount, for the book. I wanted to get the perspective of the parent of a young player who was highly sought after throughout his whole youth career. Tony told me the story of how Mason was scouted. He was playing his very first game on a grass pitch for a team called Boarhunt in Portsmouth. And that's when he was scouted. So while it's good to credit Boarhunt for giving him his first opportunity in the game, he was kind of developed elsewhere to all intents and purposes. He was scouted so early. So I guess it's probably different for each individual, but it is nice that the grassroots clubs get some credit. I think what would be even better would be if they were supported financially and propped up a little better than they are, because I've actually done a lot of work on outside of the book on Rashford as well and his development by looking at Fletcher Moss Rangers, and I've interviewed their chairman on several occasions, and he's talked about how, because Fletcher Moss Rangers are actually quite well known in the Manchester area for being a real kind of hotbed for developing young players who often go on to play for United and Liverpool and City and teams like that. He told me about how they were running one under-11s team who, I think of the 11 players, 10 of them were going on to professional academies the next year. All of them have been scouted. That's how, you know, scouts come there now, because they know that Fletcher Moss attracts and develop a level of player. They've developed, or at least gave starts to Rashford, Danny Welbeck, Ravel Morrison, Wes Brown back in the day, and others who perhaps didn't reach the same levels but also had careers in the games, like Tyler Blackett, who was at United at a young age. But they develop in these players and then they kind of lose them to professional academies. What they get from that is the reputation of being a good place to get scouted and a good place to develop, but they don't get propped up in any way financially. There's no compensation. So Dave Horrocks, the chairman, was telling me about how they've had a leaking roof in their change in facilities for a long time. The paint's falling off the doors and things like that. And they've had to kind of fundraise to try and get a new change in facility, despite the fact that they've been in some way responsible for the development of hundreds of millions of pounds worth of footballers. So while it is nice that, as you said, all these grassroots teams are getting credit, I think that a structure in which there was more of a trickle down of the finances in the game to reach those clubs and prop them up would be an even healthier way of operating. I think it would perhaps even lead to even more players coming through and being of a standard to reach a professional academy at some point.
Yeah, because with Marcus Rashford, looking now, Transfer Market have him valued at 76.5 million. And in no way is this a slight on Marcus Rashford, because what he's done for this country in the past 24 months is incredible and better than probably every MP we've had in the past 2 years. But to think that the academy that gave him his first start has a leaking roof and isn't being financially supported is definitely a sad one. And you think, considering Man United have benefited so much from Rashford and the other players that you mentioned, it definitely raises the question that, like, the FA should have a structure in place to support grassroots football, but also clubs can take individual responsibility. They shouldn't need to be told. They shouldn't need to be legislated to support. Did you find in your book, in your research for the book, did you find examples of top level professional clubs actively supporting these private academies or football schools with good framework and perhaps even funding?
I did. It wasn't something I was exploring in particular, if I'm honest. It was more the grassroots element was not something I went into in any great depth. It was more to do with what happens at these academies rather than, you know, when a player gets there. But I don't know whether it goes on. It might well. I know that clubs often have kind of special relationships and work closely with certain grassroots clubs, and there's a steady flow of players between the two often. But how much kind of financial support is given, I'm not aware of, and I'm also skeptical as to whether there is much, to be honest with you.
Of course. And to touch upon your first book, The Next Big Thing, How Football's Wonder Kids Lose Their Way, a book that I have on my shelf and I have had on my shelf for a while, but through my own writing, I've not actually got round to reading. But I bought it off the back of A, being interested in the subject and seeing your following online, and also having read the book by Michael Calvin on a very similar topic. The title escapes me, but I absolutely loved that book. So I'm really looking forward to getting to The Next Big Thing eventually. With that book, to touch upon its topic, is it something that ultimately led to you writing your second book? Because there, I can imagine there's quite a few, you know, logical chains between the two of them.
Yeah, there are. It wasn't kind of a conscious thing. I think I've always had a general interest in youth football and how young players develop and what happens to them from there, which was what sparked the idea for the first book of this general fascination with young players coming through. And then the ones who fall away, you're looking at what happens to them next when they fall out of the limelight, because they kind of get forgotten in many ways. You know, once they're no longer of great use to the clubs that they first broke through with, they fall down the leagues, or they easily fall into difficult times. So that's what I wanted to explore and kind of highlight the issues around those, and also just to put a spotlight on some of the individuals who there might be a curiosity about for many fans who would have grown up being aware of these players at the ages of 18, 19, 20, then wondering what happened to them. So that was how the first book came about, The Next Big Thing. The Dream Factory, I guess, came from a similar place of fascination. I wanted to figure out the earlier part of that journey and how these young players come to be, and also looking at the current crop of players who are coming through and thinking that, you know, there must be something going very right for English youth football at the moment, with such a steady flow of really high-level, high-potential young players coming through, and wondering how that came to be. There's a great book that I'm sure you're aware of by Raphael Honigstein called Das Reboot, that did a kind of similar thing about the German system and how they went from their kind of low point around Euro 2000, where they went out in the group stages, to the point at which they developed a generation of players who went on to win the World Cup. So I guess I was trying to do a similar thing with English football, with the Dream Factory, by speaking with players who were with coaches and players who were around the game and around youth football. It probably did help open a few doors a little bit with the access I was able to get for second book. Some of the coaches I met with were aware of my first book and understood where I was coming from with that. So I think it certainly kind of went hand in hand and helped out for sure with my ability to produce the Dream Factory. But it wasn't a conscious effort to do any kind of follow-up. It just happened to be that it was just a subject I was interested in that does have some overlap with the first one.
And we talk about that sort of that pathway that's happened and the similarities with Germany post 2000, and of course the England national youth teams have done fairly well in recent years, particularly reaching that under 20 World Cup final in 2017 and ultimately beating Venezuela 1-0. But one thing I've noticed over the years, and I do think it's changing, but we see a lot of names in the England youth national teams and particularly players that do very well, but then we don't seem to see them at the senior team. So I'm looking at the 11 that started against Venezuela in the World Cup final in 2017. And it's only Dominic Calvert-Lewin who started that game that then had any really active role in the Euros that have just finished. In comparison, Venezuela's team, Walker Fariñez, Ronald Hernandez, Nahuel Ferrarasi, Sergio Cordova, Yangel Herrera, Jefferson Soteldo, and Jan Hurtado were all in that final and have all just competed in the Copa America, which was going on at the same time as the Euros. Is there a reason for the disjoint? I appreciate there's many England players that, you know, are playing for the senior national team from the age of 19-20, so that's why. But there's also plenty of England under 20 players that have good youth careers at national level, but then never make it to the senior team.
Yeah, I think that it's a really big leap between the under 20, under 21 level in international football and the senior level. It seems to be especially the case with England. I remember even growing up, some of the players who were regulars for the under 21s kind of peaked there and stayed there. Guys like Francis Jeffers or Jermaine Pennant always seemed to be playing for the under 21s and never quite translated that to the senior level. I think there are probably a number of factors that go into that. It's, you know, the individual development of each person, of each footballer, but then also the amount of opportunities within the Premier League. It's been something that's decreased over the years as the money's flooded into the league and the drive towards immediate success has only gotten stronger. Therefore, patience with young players is minimal at times, because it's necessary that young players, when they're coming into the first team, need to go through a kind of trial and error process, need to find their feet, they need to learn the men's game and to adapt to the speed and the physicality of the professional football. And that means that they're not going to be able to be dropped in and perform to the levels that a 60 million signing from Serie A, who's 25 and is ready to come straight in, might do, you know, with the odd exception, or, you know, of course, got wonder kids like Wayne Rooney who come in ready-made and way ahead of the curve from the beginning, but they're very much the exception rather than the rule. So I think it's difficult for the young players to make that jump of being an established youth international and just becoming someone who's getting regular minutes in the Premier League. And I think that's perhaps even why we're seeing a lot of young English footballers going abroad, Jadon Sancho being the key case in point, with everything he did at Dortmund in the 4 or so years he was there, established himself in the first team there very quickly after leaving Man City. He was a first team regular by 17-18, which I don't think would have happened, even though City did claim to have a pathway ready for him. They were ready to offer him a good contract and give him opportunities in the first team and have him join the first team in pre-season just before he left. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination he would have played anywhere near the minutes he has now by the age of 21 in top-level football and been a star of a Champions League-level team. So I think people are looking to his example of how he's done it, a player who, you know, you don't really get much more talented than Jadon Sancho. So if a guy like as good as him, a prospect as great as Sancho was at 16, 17, thought that perhaps his development was best suited by going abroad, then I think others will look to that too. So, yeah, that's a big reason that it's just the opportunity is so slim for the young players. Even if you're, you know, you're one of, when you're part of an under-21s or an under-20 squad, you're one of the best sort of 23 or so young players in the country. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there are going to be 23 chances for young English players to play regular first team minutes in the coming Premier League season for any club. So I guess that there's no guarantees of anything, even when you get as far as that. And it's just an opportunity issue, I think.
And it seems almost tried to sort of carry out a mini post-mortem on an England team that have just reached the finals of the Euros and probably have their best generation of players since the golden generation. But do you think that there's perhaps lessons to be learned from English football from other countries? And I'll use Venezuela as the case in point. They limit the amount of foreigners in their starting 11 to 3. And also, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, insist that every starting lineup must have at least one player under the age of 20 in it. Are rules like this, you know, do you think they could benefit English football, or are they the kind of things that essentially look pretty in a tick boxy, but there's actually better ways to benefit our youth football than that?
Well, there are pros and cons to approaches like that, especially as it relates to how they would work in England. You can look at it and say the influx of foreign imports and expensive signings from the transfer market have really clipped the wings of young English players, and as we spoke about, really becoming a real opportunity customer for homegrown youngsters. But by the same token, those who do make it through, I guess, are exposed to a higher level of football, playing alongside guys like David Silva or Kevin De Bruyne, as Phil Foden did from a very young age. Would he have been the player he was today were he not around such quality from a young age? So maybe the few who do break through are able to come through to a higher level and with a greater footballing education behind them than they might otherwise have had. And then perhaps there's a balancing point, but I think any kind of quota on underage players, and you do see them, there are rules around homegrown players within squads and things like that. There's no stipulation for minutes or anything like that at the moment. I think while it would be a boon developmentally to the young English players trying to come through, I think it's something that clubs might be reluctant to embrace, especially as it relates to their chances of competing in Europe. Because, of course, the Premier League is one thing, but the Champions League is the ultimate goal for many of these big clubs who are developing so many of these elite young players. And they would, I guess, my theory would be that they would feel hamstrung by being limited to the amount of players that they're allowed to bring in and to not have full autonomy over their own first team squad. So I think there'll be a lot of reluctance from within the game, even though from a kind of national, international side perspective, it might be of benefit. It's difficult because the clubs hold all the power these days, especially the big six in England. To get something like that through, I think would face a lot of opposition.
And something that it was already going to happen probably before you decided to write your second book, but sort of showed its face and how exactly it was going to work. Brexit and football. From January onwards, with the new GBE point system for foreign players coming to England, how do you see that affecting the academy system and the chances that young English players will get in the next 4 to 5 years? Because now the main, downside, if you're a club looking to import players, is that the EU passport no longer means anything. There are classes of foreign player, like a player from China or Brazil would be. But secondarily, it's actually become easier to sign young South American players, for example, because the waiting on the 15-point system that you need to qualify for South American tournaments has sort of been brought level or more level with the European competition. So if you're a young South American player playing in the group stages of Copa Libertadores, for example, and you're playing for the under 20 national team, you're almost guaranteed enough points for a UK work permit. Whereas before, if you were a young South American player, your only real opportunity to get a work permit to play in the UK was through having a European passport through perhaps grandparents.
I think it is going to have a big impact. I think probably already starting to see it. It's something I did look into in the book and did write about it at some length in one of the chapters. I looked at some of the recruitment that was going on in the last few years of young European players, and it seemed that some clubs were kind of capitalizing on that, realizing that the tap was about to be turned off effectively. So Man United in particular were really strong in recruiting a lot of young European players between the ages of 16 and 18, and it seemed as though they were very aware that, like I said, that pipeline was about to be cut off. So they were milking it for all they could before that came to be. They brought in a handful of young European players, it seemed, in every transfer window, I guess fully aware that the majority of them eventually wouldn't get near their first team, but would have resale value down the line. So it's a quick and easy revenue stream for them, I guess. And going forward, how it will affect the chances of young English players within the system, I suspect it will mean that they might have the chance to get a bit further. So, for example, a player who was coming into the under-16s level at a club like United a couple of years ago would suddenly find competition for a place in the under-16s or under-18s teams very stiff, because that's the point at which the players were being imported from Europe and EU countries. And he might find that whereas his previous age group was full of English and British players, the next one he moves into, there would be fewer British players, and they'll be competing with the number of high-level imports from the continent. that's probably not going to be the case now. So they're going to maybe get that little step further, maybe get to more exposure to under-18s football, get close to the under-23s team, and have those couple of years extra to develop and prove their worth before they then face competition from, like you said, perhaps some South American players now might be more of a likelihood, or players from Africa as well as Europe. So, yeah, I think it might buy developmentally buy homegrown English players within the system, British players, an extra couple of years of development. And that could be key. You know, those could be the years at which a player really kicks on. We've seen it before. We've seen Aaron Wan-Bissaka was somebody I looked at in quite great detail in the books. I spent the day with Crystal Palace's academy. He was still there at the time. It was just before he left to join United. And the academy manager there, Gary Issett, was telling me about Wan-Bissaka's developmental path and how at 14 they were considering him for release, but by 18 he's one of their best prospects. He's been reimagined as a fullback. So had he not been given the grace of those extra few years, then he likely would have fallen down the leagues, and who knows where he could have been. Wilfred Zaha as well, who of course broke through to the Palace first team at a very young age, by 14 or 15. Their academy manager was telling me that they weren't sure what way he was going to go. He had obvious talent, but he wasn't necessarily their best prospect by any stretch of imagination. So some players just develop at that slightly slower rate, and those extra couple of years that could have been bought for them now might prove crucial. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye on that aspect of it.
So having researched and now written and close to publication of The Dream Factory, would you say England and English football is in a position to perhaps hold its academy system up as a method or a blueprint for other countries to follow? Or is there still a lot of work to be done?
I think in terms of developmentally and the players that are being produced, there's a lot of great work being done. A lot of development would work over here and have implemented it, and there's been great results. But in terms of the system as a whole, I think the attrition rates are so high. I think that I'm not sure the success rate is still high enough to say that this is a foolproof system that other countries should adopt wholesale. I think there's a lot of good that we can take and learn from that other countries can adopt and that I would suggest they do, especially with the current drive towards a focus on the individual in youth development. So teams now realizing that results and trophies and competitions at youth level should really take a backseat to the development of each individual within their team, because they're not trying to, they're at the end goal of any academy is not to create a great under 16s or under 18s team who wins all the trophies. It's to create players for the first team or for sale, essentially. So one might not necessarily be of use to the other. So if you're focusing too much on the development of a good team, you might be sacrificing the development of some of your better young players. So you've got to cater to the individual needs of each young player and provide a bespoke plan for their development, which is something that a lot of clubs now are doing. It's something that I spoke with lots of Liverpool coaches with, talked in great detail about Trent Alexander-Arnold's development, his adaptation to become a right back, and how that all worked from the very inception of that idea, and how it was sold to Alexander-Arnold, how they got buy-in from him, and then the day-to-day work on the training ground of how they made it happen. That was something I was able to be able to relay in the book. And then there was a similar story with Marcus Rashford at United, because they have a very keen focus on the individual too. So he was developed from a winger, and he was actually held back when they could have pushed him up to play under 18s or under 23s football. They kept him back playing under 16s so they could play him as a striker and work on his finishing. They knew that if they put him into under 18s when he was 16 years old, he had the ability to cope and to thrive, and he could have been of benefit to their under 18s team and their prospects. But they knew that they wanted to work on his finishing and work on his instincts as a striker, and he would get more sights at goal playing under 16s football and more chances to refine those skills. So they held him back, and lo and behold, when he made his debut as an 18-year-old in the Europa League, he scored twice on his debut, and he was off and running as this really kind of hot finisher at the very highest level. So the proof was in the pudding there. So I think that individual focus is something that I learned a lot about through my research and interviews for the book. And I think if anyone looking to implement aspects of the English system abroad would like to pick something up in particular, I think that'd be a really good starting point. But yeah, the system as a whole, though, I think there's a lot of toxicity within it and a lot of heartbreak that perhaps doesn't seem quite necessary. And it's an area of the game that I think is ripe for reform and ripe for evolution. So I wouldn't necessarily like to see that replicated elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So I think the main takeaway from that answer is probably the one thing to take from our academy system is the changing focus to the individual. To touch upon Venezuelan football and its youth development and its academy system in inverted commas, because it's certainly not something applied nationwide, and there's only a few clubs with perhaps the luxury to say that they have something similar to a European style academy system. What for clubs that are, you know, only just starting out to have an academy system, or perhaps it's a new federation in Venezuelan football as well. The league organization is freshly changed too, so it's all new and it's all fresh in Venezuela. So again, like you said, similarly ripe for reform. If you were to give three practical bits of advice to start an academy system from the ground up, what would you advise? Obviously, probably one of those three would be the focus on the individual, but maybe two other key points that you think would give any country that's starting out to develop an academy system as a reboot, if you like, to start with.
So yeah, the focus on the individual seems to be something that's worked really well in England. So I would definitely recommend looking at that and studying that and seeing how that could work in other settings. From a purely ethical point of view, I would strongly advise taking a very sort of holistic approach to developing of young people and being careful and conscious of the responsibility youth coaches and academy systems have to the young people that they take in and take care of, that they're not discarded so easily, and their experience is enriching irrespective of the outcome. So whether they make it through and go on to have a career in the game or not, they don't feel like they've wasted their years. They feel like they've come away better for the experience of being in an academy. So that's a huge aspect. And that is something that, again, the English game, I think, is catching up to. It's still got a long way to go, but I think it's something that the coaches and the academy managers I spoke to are very aware of and very, very tuned into, which was really encouraging. And then I guess just always being open to change and open to processes of review and looking at what works elsewhere and seeing what you can implement. Don't be too rigid in your structures. I think that's perhaps something as well that English football was a little slower to react to when you saw, you know, as we mentioned, the likes of how Germany adapted their system. It took us a long time to realise that what the guys over in Spain were doing was working really well at Barcelona and other academies. So, always be looking at what's happening elsewhere and seeing what you can pick up and what might work for you. Just look to have a package that is very, very sort of well-rounded. Don't get too caught up on any specific idea would I guess be my broad advice for anyone looking to implement a youth system, that it has to be malleable, it has to be flexible, it has to work for each individual rather than being a kind of one size fits all approach.
And I imagine the answer is no, because it always seems to be the way in any walk of life where you want to excel. But is there anything academies can do to see quick gains, almost like a cheat code, like a proven way of getting quick results?
Nothing I've seen, nothing I've come across. It seems very much like it's a matter of experience, of coaches, of adaptability, like I mentioned, of trial and error, and of constantly looking to update best practices. It's always going to be, because the nature of youth football and the nature of development is that there aren't immediate results. It's increments. It's always going to be increments, incremental gains. That's the way it's got to be looked at. If you're looking for quick results, you're probably looking in the wrong place and looking to do the wrong kinds of things.
Perfect. I did expect that to be the answer. Ryan, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I would encourage anyone who is interested in the youth development and academy system of English football to keep an eye out for the release of Dream Factory. When exactly is it coming out, and where's best to get the book, Ryan?
It comes out on the 5th of August, so a few weeks from now. It's available at all the usual places. You can get it directly from the publisher at polarispublishing.com. It does overseas shipping as well. You can get it from Amazon and all the usual bookshops. And it's also going to be available in ebooks. So if you're in a part of the world where shipping is going to be quite expensive for you, the ebook is a great option. So yeah, that's going to be widely available.
Perfect. And I know you said you already have some future projects on the pipeline. Are they plans that you'd like to share with us or keep to yourself?
I probably can't give too much away at this stage because I'm still in the very early stages, but I am working on my next two books, which I'm really excited about. And they're going to be a bit of a departure. They're going to be looking back and telling the stories of a couple of iconic teams from English football's not too distant past.
Lovely. And I know there's quite a few people that follow Footvey English, which is obviously where this podcast will be released from, that sort of see Footvey English and just covering football from different parts of the world as very much a labour of love or passion, and not something that could be made a career out of. But you've written two books and you're writing another two books and you're also a freelance journalist. It sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, but you make it work. You've made journalism and writing work for you. Are there any little bits of advice that you could give anyone that's perhaps listening and thinking, wow, how's he managed to make a career out of something that many people just see as a hobby?
I guess don't delay is the first thing. If you think it's something that you want to try and start doing it, start a blog. Years ago, started blogging on European football because it was something I was interested in. It was a hobby, but it exercised those muscles and find people who can help you. So reach out to other journalists you admire, see if they have any advice for you. Find editors, pitch yourself. You have to be a bit of a salesman as well at times if you're going to be a freelance writer, because you have to sell your ideas and sell your own expertise and think about why you are the person to write a certain thing and what makes you, what fresh perspective you can bring. It's all about just keep doing it, keep practicing, write as much as you can, as often as you can, get feedback from people, look to writers you admire, see and think about what you like about their work and try to take pieces from each one, and before you know it, that all comes, all those ingredients come together into your own style. And then, find people who can help you, find editors, find writers, and don't be afraid to ask for help.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And I'd like to wish you all the success with Dream Factory and obviously ongoing success with your first book, which I'll be getting round to imminently, I assure you. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Cheers, Jordan. Thanks, mate.